actresses spoke Korean with the strong accents familiar to me and wore their hair in the conservative fashion of North Korea, almost unchanged since the time of the Korean War. They were polite but reserved when engaging with customers. They knew they were each being watched by their co-workers. They were forbidden to form friendships with any customer. I guessed that at night they were confined to a dorm and not permitted to go out into the city. One particular waitress often served me, and against the rules became quite familiar with me. She was from Pyongyang. One time she astonished me by saying that she hoped to have a boob job done in Shanghai. "You can leave here to have it done." She lowered her voice. "I haven't asked yet, but it might be possible." That surprised me. Some rules could be bent, but I didn't think that was one of them. As soon as she mentioned it, I found myself searching her face. "You've had your eyes done," I exclaimed. She had double eyelids, a popular procedure among Korean women to make their eyes appear larger. "Yes." "Here?" "In Pyongyang." I almost dropped my glass. The elite in Pyongyang had access to beauty surgery. It seemed almost obscene given the poverty and hunger of most of the population. Clients visiting my company from South Korea would often ask to be taken to these restaurants, and the behaviour of some of the men made me uncomfortable. There is an old Korean proverb, "South man, North woman," meaning that the most handsome men are in the south of the peninsula, the prettiest women in the north. The proverb seemed borne out by the beauty of the waitresses, whose sheer unavailability turned some of the men into romantic idiots. They would become besotted, returning night after night to see a girl they had fallen for. I witnessed some of them handing over small, elegant gift boxes of jewellery from the luxury brand stores. To my great surprise, the waitresses would smile coyly and accept the gifts. I figured that the restaurant allowed this and confiscated them on behalf of the North Korean state. Not only were these men unwillingly donating valuables to Pyongyang, they were placing the women in a compromising and potentially dangerous situation. I don't think any of them understood the risk for a North Korean woman should they actually get what they wanted. But one of them was to find out. One evening, in my second year in Shanghai, I arrived at the Pyongyang Omanugwan to find it closed. The next morning, the gossip was all over my office. A waitress had run off with one of my company's South Korean clients, a friend of my boss, the director. Rather unwisely, the man had hidden the woman in his apartment. The North Koreans reported the disappearance to the Shanghai police, who questioned the staff, quickly identified the customer, and went straight to the man's apartment. Both were deported, he to South Korea and she to North Korea and her fate. I never found out for sure who the waitress was, but I had an awful intimation it was the friendly one who'd wanted a boob job. 2 months later, the restaurant reopened with completely new staff. By my second year in Shanghai, I sometimes forgot that I was North Korean. My friends were all Korean Chinese or South Koreans from my workplace. I socialized with them as one of them. I spoke fluent Mandarin with a Korean Chinese accent. My ID document stated I was Korean Chinese. I was enjoying my work and felt I was finally on life's upward curve. No one in the city knew my true identity. I was jolted out of this insouciance by an unexpected encounter. It was during my lunch hour on a busy street in Koreatown. A loud man's voice behind me said, "Sun Hyang?" I froze. But then I could not stop myself from turning around to see who it was. I recognized him at once, the friendly businessman from the restaurant in Shenyang who'd put me in touch with a Chinese broker, someone who probably knew full well I was from North Korea. He was smiling, waiting for me to acknowledge him. "You've mistaken me for someone else," I said, and walked away. Fear breathed on me like a draught of night air. I took this as a warning not to get complacent. I was not so safe from my past. It could catch up with me at any time. For days after that, I avoided Koreatown at lunchtime. Just a few weeks later, I was recognized again, in a much more serious incident. It was at a house party I was taken to by a colleague from work. She told me it was the birthday celebration of a charming man from Shenyang whom she knew only vaguely. When we arrived at this man's apartment, the music was booming and the drinks flowing. I was led across a crowded room to meet the host. When I saw him, I blanched. I knew him. He owned a restaurant in Shenyang. I'd met him several times and had even been on nights out with him and others. I racked my brains for an excuse to turn and leave, but it was too late. He'd seen me. "Sun Xiang?" he said. His eyes were wide with astonishment. "I don't believe it." He was genuinely happy to see me. "What are you doing here?" My work colleague gave me a puzzled look. "Sun Xiang? No," I said, laughing. "That's not me, but it's lovely to meet you." He thought I was pulling his leg. It took me several minutes to persuade him that I was not this person, Sun Xiang. My work colleague was listening to all of this. If anyone at my workplace realized I was not who I said I was, questions would be asked and my documents examined. Eventually, he scratched his head and said over the noise, "Well, I have to tell you that I know a girl in Shenyang who looks exactly like you. You must have a twin. I'm sure this is a secret only your mother knows." I had just about got away with it when a fresh group of guests arrived. "Shenyang!" A woman was waving at me from across the room and pushing her way through toward me. It was a strange feeling, being exposed so publicly, a kind of exhilaration mixed with a sickening contraction in my stomach. "Sun Xiang, I don't believe it. It's been a long time." She hugged me, right in front of the man I'd just lied to. "I didn't know you were coming." She was another acquaintance from the restaurant trade in Shenyang, a woman I'd met many times. There was no possible way I could repeat the lie to someone who so obviously knew who I was. Over her shoulder, my eyes searched for my work colleague. She was caught up in a conversation with someone and had not heard this drama over the noise of the party. But the man from Shenyang, whose party this was staring at me in bewilderment. His eyes were saying, "Why would you tell a lie like that?" I had to say something to him. "I'm sorry," I said with my head lowered. "Please don't tell anyone." I wished I could tell him why I had lied about my name, but I couldn't. I went home filled with self-loathing. Wherever I go, even in a country as big as this, the truth will catch up with me. All I could do was stay one step ahead of it by lying and deceiving. In bed that night, I cried for the first time in a long time. What I missed most was a North Korean friend I could confide in and trust, someone who would understand why I behaved in the way I had, who would tell me that it wasn't my fault, that she would have done the same. As if in answer to a prayer, fortune sent me one. Her name was Oki, and I'd known her briefly back in Shenyang. She too had been a waitress, and belonged to the small circle of North Korean friends I had started making. I had barely got to know her when the police interrogated me. After that, I had kept a low profile and shunned everyone, especially North Koreans. It was actually me who saw her first, outside a cosmetic store in Koreatown. She was extremely surprised to see me. She was a slim, quiet girl, with a charming habit of inclining her head and twirling her hair when spoken to. Over a cup of bubble milk tea, she admitted to me that her ID was fake. Her greatest fear was that her poor Mandarin would let her down and expose her. She too was fleeing the authorities in Shenyang. Oki would become a great friend to me in China. Chapter 32. A Connection to Haesan. Not long after meeting Oki, I got a call out of the blue from Mino. What he told me transformed my life. I was doubly surprised to hear him, not only because I'd been losing hope of ever speaking to my family again, but because I'd always thought that I would be the one making contact. It hadn't occurred to me that this might be in his power too. He was speaking from Mr. An's house in Changbai. After my initial elation, my spirits began to slide when he explained the reason for the call. He and my mother had money problems, he said. The cash I had given him in Changbai had been used up. Used up? I was dumbfounded. Yeah. Will you send some more? I had given them 5,000 yuan, A farmer in China makes 2,000 to 3,000 yuan a year. I figured the money would last them quite a while, even if they didn't earn anything themselves. After years in the Chinese workforce, I had developed an emotional attachment to money. My earnings were my hard work and long hours. My savings were comforts deferred. North Koreans have no way to relate to this. In the outside world, they believe money is plentifully available to all. Mino seemed to think I just had to go to a money shop and get more. There was no point telling him that I had just paid a great deal for my ID, that my rent was high, and that I had a huge debt to repay after the disaster with the gang. I sighed and said, "I'll see what I can do." He was vague about where the money had gone. I guessed that my mother must have had bribes to pay. It was only later I found out that she had been helping my uncles and aunts. At the end of the conversation, almost as an afterthought, he dropped another bombshell. This piece of information changed everything for me. "Oh, and could you send me a cell phone?" He said that people in the border area had started using cell phones to make calls to China, using the Chinese network. It was highly illegal, of course. This took a moment to sink in. The next day I bought a Nokia and a chip and sent it, along with 1,000 yuan in cash, for Mr. An to send to Mino. The first time I called the Nokia, Mino answered. Something like this was only in a happy dream. He's passing the phone to my mother. "Min Yang?" I hadn't been called that name in a long time. "Is that you?" I was hearing her voice, but it sounded strange and ethereal, as if she was speaking from another world. "Oma," I said, using the Korean word for mother. "Yes." "Is it you?" Just as with Mino, when I heard his voice on the phone, the suspicion flitted across my mind that this wasn't her, that it was some kind of trap. "Can you tell me what time of day it was when you last saw me?" She laughed, and the laugh was warmly familiar. "You left the house just after dinner, at 7 o'clock, on the 14th of December 1997, and you had those bloody fashion shoes on." Now I laughed. "How do you remember so exactly?" "How could I forget the night my little girl left me?" She remembers the exact date and time. A lump rose to my throat. I felt horrible. My Oma. Then it was her turn. She too wondered if I was an imposter. My accent was no longer North Korean. She asked a few questions to which only I would know the answers. After I'd answered the last one, she tried to say something, but choked on the word daughter. She was unable to speak. Then I too began to cry. Streams of hot tears rolled down my cheeks and onto my lap. We held our phones to our ears, 1,000 miles apart, listening to the pent-up silence for several minutes without saying a word. When I reflect on the pain I caused my mother, I know it is something I cannot fully know. I may never fathom it completely, although maybe, when I have children of my own, I will begin to understand a part of her despair. Hearing my mother's voice brought me right back to original truths, as if mooring had been pulled tight. For years, my sense of identity had drifted. In Shenyang, I had sometimes thought of myself as Korean Chinese. In Shanghai, I even sometimes thought of myself as South Korean. Her voice reactivated something strongly in me to do with identity. All the lies I'd spun around myself fell away. I was born and raised in Haesan, on the banks of the Yellow River, in the province of Mount Paektu. I could not be anything else. She told me that she had visited several fortune tellers over the years since I'd been gone. "I don't know where my daughter is, but I miss her." She couldn't say I was in China. "She's not in our land." Every one of them said that. One said, "She is like the one tree growing on the rock on the side of the mountain. It's hard to survive. She is tough and she is smart, but she is lonely." "She is well, do not worry," another said. She is living like a nobleman's wife in China. She told me she had even invited a shaman to the house to perform traditional ceremonies for my good fortune and safety in China. My mother reached out to me in the void like this, half believing and briefly comforted. "My daughter," she said to me. We got into a routine of calling every weekend. Each time my mother would call me and I would call her back. We talked for 1 or 2 hours. Sometimes we spoke for so long I would fall asleep. Her voice was so comforting. The charges for these calls came to about 150 yuan, $20 a month, but sometimes it would be 300 yuan for a single call. I had been away so long that it took weeks to catch up on all that had happened in Heisan. When my mother had reported me missing, the police were highly suspicious. She had to bribe them. After that, as I dreaded would happen, she and Mino were placed under close surveillance by the Panjang, the neighbours, and the local police. She and Mino moved house to a neighbourhood in Heisan where nobody knew them. At work, she received a promotion. This was not a sign of favour, but a way of bringing her into closer contact with the authorities so that she could be more closely watched. One day, a colleague whispered to her that he had been ordered to provide weekly reports on her for the past 3 years. He warned her to be careful. After that, she quit her job at the government bureau and got involved in the same business as Aunt Pretty, sending Chinese goods on the train for sale in Pyongyang and Hamhung. My mother admitted that she had started to have negative thoughts about the party and the system, but she used highly coded language. In all of our conversations, she made the assumption that the Puibu might be listening. The secret police were trying to catch cell phone users, but they did not yet have the technology to detect signals. The Puibu, in fact, had already paid her a visit. I found the incident she described particularly unsettling. My mother arrived home from work to find two plainclothes Puibu officers waiting in the house with Mino. The one in charge started to ask about me. "He was extremely polite," she said. "It was chilling." He asked to see my photograph, and she showed him the family album. He leafed carefully through every page.
"She's very beautiful," he said, and then, "Would you describe for me again how she went missing?"
My mother told him what she'd reported to the police at the time. He then made an extraordinary offer. "If I was indeed in China," he said, "and I paid 50,000 yuan, more than $6,000, I could come home to North Korea, have my old life back, and not face charges." He sounded very conciliatory, but my mother balked at the idea of me returning and publicly admitting where I'd been. It felt like a trap. She stuck to the story that I had gone missing. My mother was convinced that she could get me home to North Korea without me having to admit anything, and she badly wanted me to come home. She had already spoken to the authorities about what would happen if I were to come back. "They said that, as you were not an adult when you left, you committed no crime. But the records will show I've been officially missing for years. We can pay to have the record changed. Look, you're at an age when you should think of getting married. You have to marry in North Korea. Would it be safe to go back?" "I'll make it safe for you." She was adamant. We had this conversation many times. Returning to Heisan, being united with her and my uncles and aunts, was a dream. But could I really cross back secretly and then report to the authorities, as my mother was suggesting, saying that I was a child when I left and had committed no crime? The more I thought about it, the more I was tempted to make the decision to go home and have the life I should have had. But a small incessant voice in my head was stopping me. A part of me knew that she and I were deluding ourselves. Returning now, after so many years away, was insanely dangerous. On one occasion, my mother called me with an alarming question. Normally we spoke on the weekends, but this time her call came during the day while I was at work. She sounded excited. "I've got a few kilos of ice."
"What?"
I sank down in my seat, out of sight of my colleagues. She wanted to know if I had connections in China who could sell it.
Ice, or crystal methamphetamine, had long replaced heroin in North Korea as the foreign currency earner of choice for the state. It's a synthetic drug that is not dependent on crops, as heroin is, and can be manufactured to a high purity in state labs. Most of the addicts in China were getting high on crystal meth made in North Korea. Like the opium of the past, crystal meth, though just as illegal, had become an alternative currency in North Korea and given as gifts and bribes.
Omar!
My voice was a furious whisper.
Do you know what that is? It's highly illegal.
Well, lots of things are illegal. In her world, the law was upside down. People had to break the law to live. The prohibition on drug dealing, a serious crime in most countries, is not viewed in the same way, as protective of society, by North Koreans. It is viewed as a risk, like unauthorized parking. If you can get away with it, where's the harm? In North Korea, the only laws that truly matter, and for which extreme penalties are imposed if they are broken, touch on loyalty to the Kim dynasty. This is well understood by all North Koreans. To my mother, the legality of ICE was a trifling matter. It was just another product to trade. She said one of the big local traders brought it to the house because he knew I was in China and wondered if I could sell it there. Give it back to him. Never get involved. There are bad people in that trade, and they won't care if you're caught. She never asked me again. Sometimes, neither she nor Mino would call for 2 or 3 weeks. At those times, I couldn't focus on anything. I became convinced they were in a Puibu cell. I'd just stare at the phone and will it to ring. I'd made a special ringtone for their calls. It was a Korean comedy rap that went, Kong Kong Da, Kong Kong Da. I'd start hearing the ringtone in my dreams and even imagine I'd heard it while I was awake. I would constantly check the phone. Then, weeks later, it would ring. My relief was overwhelming. Power cuts, my mother might say. I couldn't charge the phone. This happened regularly, but each time I could never suppress my panic and paranoia. On a weekend evening in spring 2004, I was enjoying a long chat with my mother. I had my feet up. The television was on in the background as usual, with the volume low. As we talked, I was distracted by news footage on the screen. Oki was with me in the apartment. She noticed it too. Omar, I'll call you back, I said. I grabbed the remote and turned the sound up. The footage replayed in slow motion. A group of men, women and children were making a desperate bid to rush past some Chinese guards and enter a gate. It was the South Korean embassy in Beijing. Somehow they had distracted the guards, who were now lunging toward them and grabbing them to prevent them reaching South Korean diplomatic territory. One or two made it through, but a guard caught one woman by her coat and pulled her to the ground. The violence he used was shocking. He picked her up by her waist and carried her off. One of her shoes was left on the ground. The news anchor said they were North Koreans seeking political asylum. Asylum? Oki and I stared at each other. Chapter 33. The Teddy Bear Conversations. Over the following months, the television news showed similar events unfolding outside other countries' embassies in Beijing, and even at a Japanese school. Sometimes none of the North Koreans made it through the gates, and they were hauled away by police and plainclothes agents. The howls of despair on their faces affected me deeply. These desperate bids for asylum were being filmed by a human rights organization to highlight China's inhumanity in refusing to treat escaped North Koreans as asylum seekers. I thought of my uncle's tirade against North Korea when I'd arrived in his apartment in Shenyang over 6 years ago, and the bizarre truths he told me about the Korean War and the private life of Kim Jong-il. I'd refused to believe them. Ever since, I closed my mind to the reality of the regime in North Korea. Unless it directly affected my family, I had never wanted to know. I thought the reason people escaped was because of hunger, or, like me,
out of an unexamined sense of curiosity. It had never occurred to me that people would escape for political reasons. I remembered the two South Korean filmmakers I'd met in Shenyang, who'd offered to pay the broker's fees for a defector trying to get to South Korea. I'd had cold feet because I thought I'd be treated as an exotic arrival from the North who'd have to give a press conference. Until now, I'd had no idea of the sheer numbers, thousands each year, trying to escape, or that most of them did not want to live in China, but in South Korea. The cell phone had transformed my life by reconnecting me with my family. Now, so too did the internet, linking me to what the world was saying about North Korea. I started discreetly researching online from cybercafes. My searches were narrow in scope to begin with. The first intriguing fact I learned was that so many North Koreans were now reaching South Korea that none of them had been asked to give a press conference in years. I'd been in Shanghai more than 2 years now. In that time, I'd learned a great deal about South Korea from my colleagues. I regularly watched South Korean TV dramas. Some of them were such addictive viewing that Oki and I would dash home to my tiny apartment and watch them together, lying on my roll-out mat. But I had never imagined myself in South Korea until I saw these desperate people storming embassy gates. They were risking their lives. The reward had to be worth it. The more I thought about it, the more the idea of living among South Koreans excited me. I was Korean, and so were they. In China, however fluent my Mandarin, however official my ID, I would always be, at heart, a foreigner. This soon became the main topic of conversation between Oki and me. The idea had taken a powerful hold over her too. Could we go to South Korea together? I knew I would do nothing so heroic as storming an embassy gate. With my Korean-Chinese ID, I thought I could simply apply for a visa and fly to Seoul. From reading online, however, I learned that a visa wouldn't be easy. The South Koreans would need to be convinced that I would return to China and not stay illegally. Oki had contacts with other North Koreans living secretly in Shanghai. She was the sole North Korean I knew in the city. It was she who found a broker. The man had a simple suggestion. She and I should pose as South Koreans who'd lost our passports. We would report the loss to the police, then go to the South Korean embassy in Beijing to apply for new ones. The broker would prepare the necessary documents. He wanted an advance of 10,000 yuan, about $1,400, from each of us on his fee. After a long discussion in a cafe in Longbai over cups of melon soya milk tea, Oki and I decided we'd go for it. We gave each other a high five. I went to bed that night with a sense of destiny. The next day, however, as we stood in line at the bank to withdraw our money for the broker's fee, Oki was even quieter than usual and continually twirling her hair. I knew her well enough to see that she had the jitters. "I'm not sure this is going to work," she said. "The fortune teller told me it was not in my fortune this time to leave the country." "It'll work," I said. I felt confident. "I think we only have a 50% chance. It could go either way." Her fear was that the broker would either take our money and disappear, or the documents he produced would look so phony it would be too risky to use them. I told her she was being paranoid. I thought our chances were good. If all went well, we'd soon begin a new life. I could still call my family, using the Chinese network, and even travel to Changbai when I had a South Korean passport. Naively, I thought that if we didn't like South Korea, I might still eventually return home. I was still young. My mother was still trying to persuade me back. In fact, Oki's fears and superstitions were well-founded. Fortune, as I would soon find out, was not smiling on this venture. I started to wind up my life in Shanghai and get rid of my possessions. There was something final about this that I found unsettling, and it was mixed with deep feelings of guilt. I knew that my mother would be dead set against me going to South Korea. Over the following days, these thoughts sent my spirits into a downward spiral.
It was the result of a routine medical checkup that tipped me into depression. I was told my blood sugar level was dangerously high. In my despondent frame of mind, I became convinced that I was about to die. Like the time I was in the hospital in Shenyang after the attack, I thought that if I died now, alone in my apartment, no one would know who I was. My mother would spend the rest of her life trying to find me. The little money I had in the bank would never reach her. I stopped thinking about South Korea. I stopped caring about anything. I lay awake on my mat at night, watching the fluorescent lights blinking in the new office block built barely 5 yards from my apartment. My thoughts turned suicidal. I did not feel able to talk to anyone, not even to Oki. I bought a small teddy bear for company. Because I worried that I might faint and die while I was eating, I sat the bear at the table where he could watch over me. At first, we didn't talk. But one evening after work, I started talking to him as if he were a baby, in long babbling conversations. To ward off the loneliness of the apartment, I set a timer so that the television came on 30 minutes before I got home. I criticized myself for wasting money on electricity, then ignored the criticism. Throughout that month, convinced that I was about to die alone without ever saying goodbye to my family, I was utterly broken. I decided to blow my savings on expensive clothes. Just for once, I'll live the good life, I thought. I couldn't tell my mother that I was sick. Adding to her pain wouldn't remove any of mine. I planned to keep up my calls to her until the last moment. I thought long and hard about how to explain the coming silence, and decided to tell her I was leaving for another country and wouldn't be able to call North Korea any longer. After a month living like this, Oki and other friends became so worried that they urged me to get another blood test. This time, the results were normal. Apparently, the blood sugar spike in the first test was to do with not having had any sleep the night before. I was given the all clear, and all I had to show for myself was some overpriced clothes. The self-pity and despondency lingered on in me for a few weeks, until an event in Haesan shocked me out of it and pulled me back together. Chapter 34. The Tormenting of Mino. As part of my preparations to leave Shanghai, I had sent some money and almost all of my belongings to Mr. Ahn's house in Changbai. After the shipment had arrived there, I travelled to Changbai myself, my first visit since the ordeal with the gang. I arrived on a clear night in early October 2004. Standing beneath the trees on the riverbank, I stared across at North Korea. The mountains were black against the constellations. Haesan itself was in utter darkness. I could have been looking at forest, not at a city. It was almost as if the sky was the substance. The city was the void, the nothing. My country lay silent and still. I felt immensely sad for it. It seemed as lifeless as ash. Then, in the far distance, an ember, the headlights of a lone truck moving down a street. Mrs. Ahn greeted me with the news that Mr. Ahn had died. He had struggled to recover from his injuries and had been very ill with diabetes. This affected me more than I expected. She invited me in. I saw his walking sticks and my eyes became heavy with tears. I had grown up with him always there, just across the river, a kind man my mother trusted. He had become my lifeline in China, the only connection I had to my family, to my past, to my real self. Mrs. Ahn helped me arrange the items I wanted to send across. They were everyday things, but they were rare and of great value in North Korea. I put my iron, hairdryer, some jewellery, vitamin pills, Chanel perfume, and all the other bits and pieces into two large blue sacks and a smaller white one. I rolled up all of my cash in US dollars and Chinese yuan and put it in the small white sack. I called Mino and asked when I should send it. Tomorrow during the day. In broad daylight. Don't worry, the guards will be all right. Mrs. Ahn hired two smugglers to carry the sacks across the river. When they returned, they said Mino had been waiting for them.
Everything had gone smoothly. I breathed a sigh of relief, paid them their fee, and waited for Mino's call. No call came. Nor did he call the next day. I walked along the riverbank, studying Heysam. This was my first proper look at my old home since I'd left all those years ago. In the week I'd spent as a prisoner of the gang, I never got a good view of it. The only traffic was a couple of military jeeps and an ox pulling a cart. I'd never seen one of those in the city streets when I'd lived there. I could see a smiling portrait of Kim Il-sung on the side of a distant building, the only dash of colour. Everything looked dilapidated and poor. Nothing had changed. In China, nothing stayed the same. Everywhere was such a frenzy of construction and reinvention that a city could be unrecognizable within a year. I could not stand still. With each passing hour, my desperation mounted. Something had gone wrong. I waited two more days in Chiang Mai, staying in a cheap hotel, the only place I had found open when I'd arrived so late at night. I couldn't sleep from worry, and because the walls were so thin, I heard men talking in the next room. They had strong North Korean accents. I didn't know if they were Puibu agents or smugglers, but it added to a presentiment I felt in my stomach, of dread and impending disaster. On the fourth day, after still no word from Mino, I returned to Shanghai. A week later, just as I was leaving work to go home, my phone rang. It was Mino.
Nuna, what did you send?
No greeting, just this blunt question. An iron, a hairdryer, some vitamin pills, other stuff, I said. I went through the list without mentioning the money. I asked him why he hadn't called. He ignored my question and asked again. What had I put into the sacks? I just told you. He hung up. I could make no sense of his call. The next morning, my phone rang again. A man spoke.
I am a friend of your mother's, he said.
His voice was deep and reassuring. He didn't have a Heysan accent.
There's been a small problem because of the items you sent. I want to take care of matters for her, but I need to know how much money was in the sack.
It was a curious twist of fate that I could be paranoid and suspicious of the most innocent and well-meaning people. But when real danger spoke mellifluously into the phone, I did not suspect a thing.
Thank you for helping her, I blurted. I'd often wondered if my mother might meet another man. She was not yet 50. I thought this might be a boyfriend. You're welcome. Now, you sent a hairdryer, didn't you?
Yes.
And an iron?
Yes. He went through the list of items.
What about the money? How much was in there?
I can't remember how much now, I said. My mother will know. You'd better ask her. I really appreciate your help.
Not at all, he said, and ended the call.
A week later, Mino called again. I was in a Koreatown supermarket doing my grocery shopping.
You did well, Nuna, he said.
What do you mean?
Our calls for the past week have been recorded.
I stopped still, in an aisle of globe artichokes and pak choi.
That man you spoke with was a senior army commander. He was calling from a conference room. The phone was on speaker so that others in the room could hear.
Others? He explained how he had borrowed a car in order to pick up the sacks at 2 p.m. Everything had been arranged with the border guards. But as he was loading the sacks into the car, a ranking army officer appeared in the distance on a bicycle, saw what was happening, and started yelling. The guards fled. Mino drove off at speed. That night, 7 or 8 armed troops had hammered on the door of the house. They searched and found the 2 blue sacks, but not the third, the small white one, which Mino had hidden outside the house. He and my mother were arrested and taken into custody at the Heysan barracks of the Korean People's Army. Under interrogation, Mino insisted that everything was contained in the 2 blue sacks. He denied any knowledge of a third white sack, even though the army officer was certain he had seen three sacks. They locked him in a cell. Shortly afterwards, two uniformed interrogators entered and started beating him around his head with rubber blackjacks and kicking him. Still, he denied everything. He knew how much cash was in the white sack. I had told him. He said he'd rather die than let these bastards have it. Oh, Mino. I stood frozen listening to this, with my basket at my feet and mothers with children jostling past me. From her cell, my mother could hear my brother's cries and howls as he was thrashed. She hoped he'd confess immediately, but he didn't. Minute after minute it went on. She couldn't bear it. She banged on the iron door of her cell as hard as she could and yelled that she would tell them what they wanted to know. She confessed straight away to the small white sack and told them where it was hidden. The amount of money took the soldiers by surprise. They called in a senior army commander. He said he had never seen so large a sum coming across the border. He thought it was a fund sent by South Korean spies, and that I might be an agent of the South Korean intelligence service, the Ngibu. That was when they made Mino call me. When they heard my voice, they exchanged glances. The fact I no longer spoke with a North Korean accent was not a good sign. It increased their suspicion that I was a South Korean agent. When the call came from the senior army commander, of course I had no idea what was happening. It was just as well, because my responses and my relaxed manner convinced him that I had acted privately and had just wanted to send some items and cash to my family. The army officers then presented my mother and Mino with a deal. Under normal circumstances, they said, the two of them should go to a prison camp. However, if they agreed to say nothing, they would be released. They agreed. The officers then gave the hairdryer and some of the vitamins to my mother, leaving her a few in each bottle, and stole everything else, including all the cash, my hard-earned savings. Months had now gone by since Oki and I had last heard from the broker who was meant to be preparing documentation for our supposedly lost South Korean passports. With the alarming events in Haesan and the continuing delay, we became more and more nervous. What happened next convinced me that our fortunes were flowing in a very bad direction. In a brief and urgent call, my mother told me that she and Mino were departing Haesan immediately to stay with Aunt Pretty in Hamhung. She would not be able to contact me again for some time. Just days after she and Mino had been released by the army, Pyongyang had ordered one of its periodic crackdowns against corruption and capitalism. A team of Puibu special investigators had arrived in the city. The neighbours knew that my mother had been in some kind of trouble. They had seen armed troops at her house. They denounced her, and she was ordered to appear at the Puibu headquarters in Haesan, where she was told to wait, and waited for hours. She knew that people who entered that place sometimes did not come out. She asked to use the bathroom. Then she locked the door, climbed out through a tiny window, jumped over a wall, and ran down the street. The situation had become too serious even for my mother to solve with her usual bribes and persuasion. But she also knew how it went with these campaigns from Pyongyang. If you made yourself scarce while the investigation was on, you could usually return quietly when it had all blown over, without consequences. She closed up the house and called to tell me she was leaving. That settled it. Everything seemed dogged by such ill fortune that I became afraid. Using fake documents to obtain South Korean passports now seemed like the worst idea I'd ever had. It would most surely end in catastrophe, with Oki and me being repatriated to North Korea. Oki agreed. We called the broker and cancelled the arrangement. It was 3 months before my mother felt it safe to return to Haesan. She took the precaution of presenting a new Chinese refrigerator and a large sum of cash to the head of the investigation team in order to have her name removed from the list of suspects, and went back to her house. The next-door neighbours who denounced her stared at her as if they'd seen a ghost. She had to greet these upstanding citizens and smile as if everything had been a harmless misunderstanding. "The rumour was that you'd been deported to a prison camp," they said. They had expected government officials to come any day to take possession of her house. Once she was inside and had closed the front door, she sank to the floor. She realized she'd soon have to move again, to a new neighborhood. Chapter 35. The Love Shock. Another year passed in Shanghai. I found a well-paid new job at a cosmetics company in the Mihang district. I was the interpreter for the owner, a Japanese gentleman who spoke neither Mandarin nor Korean very well. I moved into a better apartment in Longbai. I liked my new street with its shady sycamore trees. Families lived at close quarters. It was an aspiring neighborhood that retained a faint edge of slum, typical of Shanghai. Pensioners in Mao-era padded jackets would sit on doorsteps playing mahjong, oblivious to the Prada-clad girls sweeping past on their way to work. Most of the friends in my social circle, with the exception of Oki, were now South Korean expatriates. We dined out often and made excursions on weekends. I was 25 years old. I couldn't complain about my life. The emptiness in the core of me was something only Oki understood. One evening in early 2006, my friends thought it fun to go for upmarket drinks in the Sky Bar of one of the luxury hotels on the Bund. Several of these bars had opened, competing to offer the most panoramic views of the Pudong skyline across the Hangpu River. In the group was a man I hadn't met before. We were introduced. I felt an instant and powerful connection with him, like an electric shock. He was the most flawless man I'd ever seen. Glossy black hair swept back, a beautifully proportioned face, a straight nose that ended in a fine point, tailored suit and cufflinks. His name was Kim, he said. He was visiting on business from Seoul. We sat in the window and began talking. Almost at once the two of us were in a bubble, as if we were the only people in the bar. We forgot about the friends sitting next to us. The lights dimmed from pink to gold, and the view across the river began to sparkle, illuminating the clouds. He seemed reluctant to talk much about himself, and chose his words carefully, a reserve I found appealing. When one of our friends chimed in that he'd done some modelling, I wasn't surprised. I liked his manner. He wasn't trying to flirt or impress me, but I could see in his eyes that he liked me very much. There was a trace of arrogance, of the confidence that comes with status and money. But that, too, I kind of liked. Something cut me loose from whatever kept me grounded. I was floating on air. After what seemed like minutes, someone said the bar was closing. We had been there more than 4 hours. I had never before experienced time contracting in such a way. He called me next day and asked if I'd like to have dinner. He had one day left in Shanghai before returning to Seoul, he said. I already felt strongly enough about him to know that I would suffer once he'd gone, so I said no. I was afraid of being hurt. I lay awake that night, regretting this. You fool. Now you'll never see him again. In the morning, I called him back. I asked if he had time for coffee before his flight. When I saw him waiting for me in a cafe in Longbai, and he stood to greet me, I thought he had an aura of light. I asked if he could delay his return home. He made a call and said he could stay a few more days. I prayed again, something I only seem to do in extreme situations. I know this man is not a match for me. We come from different worlds, but please let me date him for a few days. The next week passed in a trance. Until now, I had never been open to the possibility of romance. My emotional devotion to my mother and brother had always eclipsed all other feelings. The sexual instinct I knew existed inside me was one I'd always kept deeply hidden. In fact, I had hardly ever even kissed a man before. Kim's extra few days in Shanghai turned into a month. That month would turn into 2 years. Soon he had rented an apartment just a few minutes' walk from mine in Longbai. We had entered into a serious relationship almost from the moment we'd met. Kim had graduated from university in Seoul and was working for his parents, managing a small portfolio of property investments they had in Shanghai. He opened a door onto a world I'd only ever glimpsed before. Money had never been a worry for him. His life seemed effortless, his problems all highly rarefied, to do with rental yields, occupancy, presentations to planning officials. He seemed unaware of the respect people showed him, because he'd never been treated differently. He had no difficulty getting tables at fashionable French restaurants on the Bund. When he flew in China on business, he'd take me with him. He had a dark side, I discovered, a reckless streak, which I suspected stemmed from the fact that he'd only ever done what his parents had expected of him and had never made his own choices in life. On one trip to Shenzhen, he took me to a private country club set in landscape tropical grounds, with gleaming limousines and sports cars parked outside. The club had a late disco bar where breast-enhanced women got up to dance on tables. I was shocked, but Kim looked mildly bored. A bottle of complimentary champagne was presented to us. I don't drink alcohol, so Kim drank it all. I saw only flashes of this occasionally. Most of the time, he was sensitive, loving, and quiet. He was discreet to the point of secretive. He was someone I wanted to trust with my secret. I felt more and more certain he was the man I would marry. And that meant that South Korea was back on my agenda. For the first time, I told my mother that I wanted to go to South Korea. She did not take the news well. "Why do you want to go to the enemy country?" she said. "This could cause us even bigger problems." But I could hear the resignation in her voice. "Mino and I were the same," she said. "Headstrong, disobedient, obstinate." Not even a beating in an army cell had budged Mino. She knew the Haesan stubbornness in me would win out. "I have no roots in China. It's not my home. South Korea is at least Korean."
"But you'll have to marry soon."
With each passing year, she was becoming increasingly worried that I was unmarried. She'd been looking for a husband for me, she said, a man of good songbun who could earn money, and whose family she could trust with our secret. She talked of candidates in Haesan she'd started betting on my behalf. Again, she was adamant that she could bribe officials and fix documents so that I could return without punishment. I didn't have the heart to tell her that my reason for going to South Korea was to marry a South Korean man I loved. About a year after meeting Kim, I quit my job and lived for a while off my savings. With my free time, I started investigating in earnest how I might get to Seoul. Reading the posts on a South Korean website set up by defectors, I saw that dozens of people were asking the question I had. "I am illegal in China. How do I get to Seoul?" Defectors who had made it offered their advice. I had thought there had simply been a rush of people trying to get to South Korea in 2004. Now it was 2007, and the flow of defectors was greater than ever. I called the helpline of the website in Seoul. A sympathetic lady gave me a broker's number. With great patience, the man talked me through my three options. Because I had a Chinese ID, I could get a Chinese passport, he said. However, as I was single, it would be hard to get a visa because I would not be able to convince the South Korean authorities that I would return to China. The easiest way, therefore, would be to marry a Chinese man with relatives in South Korea who could send us an invitation to visit. I dismissed that idea out of hand. But the second option was almost as bad. This was to pay for a fake visa and fly directly. It would cost about $10,000. It was expensive and seemed extremely risky to me. If the visa were exposed as fake, I would be sent back to China and investigated by the Chinese police, who would discover that my whole identity was fake. The third option was to travel to a third country, such as Mongolia, Thailand, Vietnam, or Cambodia, which would give any North Korean who crossed its borders refugee status and allow them to travel to South Korea. That route would cost around $3,000. However, it could involve very lengthy periods of waiting while my status was assessed. When the call ended, I felt a wave of depression. None of these options appealed. I was no further forward, but I wasn't giving up now. After almost 10 years living in China, I was no longer accepting of my indeterminate status. I wanted to resolve it, and I wanted to marry Kim. A few nights later, Kim and I were dining out with friends. I wasn't feeling hungry or very social. I was still mulling over what the broker had told me. Waiters served enormous steamed crabs. We messily picked the white flesh from coral-pink shells. When my bowl was cleared away, I saw that my paper placemat displayed a map of the world, with Shanghai at its center. A red Chinese dragon undulated across the top and another along the bottom. I looked for the other countries the broker had mentioned, Thailand, Mongolia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. I wasn't even sure where they were. It took me a minute to find them. Although all these countries were in Asia, China was so vast that none of them was near Shanghai. Kim said, "You all right?" I told him I was just tired. I folded the placemat and put it into my handbag. Next morning I awoke at first light. Something was niggling me about that map. I retrieved it from my bag and spread it out on the table. I looked hard at each of the countries the broker had mentioned. A tingling sensation spread across my scalp as the realization came to me. I don't need a fake visa. I don't need to seek asylum in a faraway country. And I don't need to marry a Chinese man. All I need to do is get to Incheon International Airport in Seoul. I called Oki. Her voice was heavy with sleep. "I think I figured a way," I said. I knew that with a Chinese passport, I could obtain a visa for Thailand. If I could book a flight to Bangkok via Incheon International Airport in Seoul, then once I was in transit in Seoul, I would declare that I was a North Korean and ask for asylum. Visas were for normal visitors. I wasn't a normal visitor. I was a defector. I would have to book a return ticket in order to allay any suspicions at the exit immigration in Shanghai. Next time Kim and I ate out with our South Korean friends, I asked one of them if such a route was feasible, without telling him why. He said, "Are you nuts? Who flies a route like that?" He had a point. My ticket would have to be for Shanghai, Incheon, Bangkok, Incheon, Shanghai. A route that defied all logic. How would I explain to exit immigration in Shanghai that I was flying to Bangkok, which is southwest, on a 2,000-mile detour via Incheon, which is northeast, when I didn't have a visa for South Korea but was only transiting through the airport? I would need a convincing story. While I thought about this, I applied for a Chinese passport. It was processed much quicker than I expected and arrived by mail. I then applied for a Thai visa. The travel agent sent my passport to the Thai consulate in Beijing, and it was returned a week later, visa included. I was almost ready to take the plunge, buying the round-trip plane ticket. Oki, meanwhile, couldn't apply for a Chinese passport using her fake ID. That would never work. So she paid a broker for a fake South Korean passport. That would at least get her to South Korean immigration control. She opted for a different route, taking the ferry from Qingdao to Incheon. One thing remained, the matter I could put off no longer. I had to tell Kim the truth about myself. Chapter 36. Destination Seoul. On a cold, sunny weekend in December, Kim was